Greetings, Grapple fans. Duncan Steer speaking. On the phone today, Carlton Kirby. Hello, Carlton Kirby.
Oh, bonjour. Indeed, and all things greetings. We've got a season coming, for goodness sake.
Real racing.
And real racing. What are we going to do with the podcast? I mean,
we're going to end it.
Be required anymore?
What do you mean required? It's perfectly required. We've got a full guide to most of the cycling season. So just go back and listen to it as and when required. It's all
That's
there.
True. Yeah. Yeah, so no need for to put the screens around us and hear a two dull thuds. We go on, at least for today.
So, I mean, it has to come to an end, all good things, but we will be doing another Zoom cast.
And some bad things.
A second Zoom cast. Are we going to do that July the 16th? Thursday, July the 16th. Does that make sense, Carlton Kirby?
We need to book somebody as well. Our friend from Paris was brilliant on the first.
On the first,
set
yeah.
everyone alive.
So if you came to our first episode, which a percentage of the podcast listeners came to, and that percentage was about 7, but you know, 7%. Chip in, because this may be your last chance to enjoy. But so we had a rambling conversation. We had some gambling tips that may be very lucrative, and we had some musical guests playing from a Parisian courtyard at twilight. Not bad for a fiver.
Rambling, gambling, meandering.
Oh, good.
There were three ings.
It's good, isn't it? It's as if there was a script. There's not a script, but I can say on the piece of paper in front of me, it does say Mike and Bernie Winters. So that is what? That's all we've got, Mike and Bernie Winters. That's what we're going on today. In fact, what we're going on today, so please check out Carlton's Twitter, at Carlton Kirby, my Twitter, at The Third Umpire, RadioDaysEvents.com, that sort of thing, and we'll have full details of the event on July the 16th. We'll have a couple of guests on that one, you know, because it's going to be celebrating the start of proper racing, and which is what? That's a week later, July the 23rd. We go to Romania, Carlton.
It's the Sibiu, yeah. Yes. It's where the sprinters will indeed start to spin up their legs. They can have a late race ahead of the Tour de France, which of course starts quickly. And so they're going to want to be at their best, and part of that prep is a late run of some quick stages, of which you'll get in Romania.
So Carlton Kirby, like a caged lion, is going to be released back into the wild. Instead of doing theoretical podcasts about abandoned races, it's going to be live. Are you ready for that? Do you practice? You practice your commentary during the fallow weeks.
Oh yeah, well I've been doing some classics. In fact, this weekend I'm revoicing pretending I'm much younger from 2011, the famed Galibier Tour, Galibier stage 18 from 2011, where Cadel Evans basically set his stall out to win the race. The Schleck brothers dominated the day. Contador went pop, and Tommy Vokler, licking his imaginary ice cream the way he used to do, got all the way up to the top and stayed in yellow by 19 seconds. And France went nuts. They'd found another hero to worship who wasn't going
to
win it.
To let him down just when they thought he wouldn't let him down. So hang on. So you're revoicing the old episodes. Where can they be seen? Are they being shown?
On Eurosport.
No, but they're being shown during... See, this period is when the Tour de France should have taken place. So,
yes.
So you're showing some vintage then? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, we're doing some vintage. Every weekend, we're doing... each day features a classic stage, starting off with 11. So I do 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. It's quite self-explanatory, really. And, yeah, they're well worth a look, because, if nothing else, to remind yourself of some of the really weird jerseys that used to hang around, and also the way the colour palette seems to follow itself, which I've actually just done my colouring in on the start list, and everyone was in white that year. It was just incredible. Like, for goodness sake, give us a chance. And then, of course, a couple of years later, everyone was basically in black because the sky looked so groovy. They thought we'd better go dark. And nowadays, everyone's in red. Oh, dear. You just can't figure it out.
I don't know.
Get yourself a colour palette and pick something different.
Do you think Mercedes Formula One, now they're going to have the black cars, and that's in support of Black Lives Matter? Do you think that's a very fulsome political protest there, painting your car black? Isn't black already a popular colour for a car? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think it looks sort of smoky groovy. Are they going to take, what are they going to take? I don't know, sponsorship from Hugo Boss, traditionally black. It's just like the SS uniforms.
Well, exactly. Now we have to go down the Hugo Boss dressing the Nazis. So I was just trying to... Anyway, let's not go down that rabbit hole.
Where does it stop? Where does it stop?
Oh, that stops there. So we're going to do, because this should be the Tour de France, this is the Carlton Kobe Cycling Lock-In, where we talk about all the races that have been abandoned or cancelled. And the Tour de France is now should now have been in full swing. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. We did that on our live show, but I felt we concentrate more on the gambling than the tourism and travelogue.
Yeah, well, the other thing is as well, we've covered a lot of this year's routes because we spoke of the Dauphiné in one of our earlier podcasts. So don't be aggrieved that we're cramming the whole of the Tour de France into one sweet nut, which is what we're going to do for you right now. May well be slightly bitter. I don't know. Do you like walnuts? You've got to ask yourself these questions.
You don't often buy walnuts, do you?
No. They're usually the sort of fag end, aren't they, of the mixed nut selection at Christmas time. And you sort of pull them out. The last two nuts in the jar. That's us, really, isn't it? But let's get on with it. Where are we going? What are we doing?
Well, we're going to pick out a few. Okay, let's put it like this. If I were going to go and watch a stage of the tour and going to enjoy an interesting local town, scenery, history, as well as a good bit of racing, maybe you could pick out a couple of good spots for this year's tour.
Well, the ones that shout out at me are the weird ones, to be honest. And there's some pretty weird ones. And the weird one, the weirdest of all for me, is Puy-Marie or Le Puy-en-Velay. Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't. No.
It is. It takes the spookiness of Lourdes and it dials it up to the max, gives it a polish, and displays it very quietly, almost in the dead centre of France, and we're going there. It's a funny old place. It was a confluence of three rivers, I think. And as they washed through, they sort of took away all the soft rock and left the granite. And these outcrops, these sort of pitons, if you like, little tiny mounts, looks like something from a... It looks otherworldly, genuinely. It looks like something was created by a mad gamer. You know, kids, Fortnite, think of that. And then think, you know, dialed up to the max in terms of vividness. It really is a shockingly overpowering place. Because on top of each one of these mounts, they put a chapel or a statue. And the biggest of all is the Madonna and Child, built out of terracotta. And when it rains, the thing becomes shiny, so that when the storm cloud passes and the sun, a sunspot, a beam of light comes from behind the cloud and shines upon the statue, you get the idea. It starts to shine and glow and redemption is at hand. Except, of course, if you lose the day by inches in the run-in. But anyway, yeah, we're Puy-Marie. I'm actually just reminding myself whether we're starting or stopping there.
We're
finishing.
13th. Yeah, it's stage 13.
Oh gosh, I've taken a big vault. Well, this is episode 13, if you count our Zoom chat of our little get-together. So it seems appropriate. But the Puy area is bonkers. I went there and I remember going into a hotel. It was a perfectly lovely hotel, very modern actually, which I was surprised at. But when I got in there, it was just heavy with iconography, and it was clearly a place for upmarket pilgrims. So they had to sort of do something to make it slightly hard wearing. You can't give them everything. So what they did was they omitted to install air conditioning, and it was extraordinarily hot. And I remember at night just like sweating so much in this beautiful, stripped back but very comfortable room. It's like an apartment, really. And I opened the windows. And it was, because it was close to midsummer, as the Tour de France is, of course, it was still, it was in the middle of the night. So it was dawn. And dawn coming early, sort of 4:30, that kind of thing.
Mm.
And the monks were already up with the morning vespers. Oh, goodness me. I mean, they're very active in the morning and then have a snooze through the rest of the day when the rest of us want to get into the monasteries. But the monks were up and I was thinking, this can't be right. Am I going to have to bury the lazy monks thing? And then, of course, I couldn't get their sort of wailing out of my... out of my out of my head for the rest of the day. It's very mournful and quite lovely, really. It was a day where I was given to some affection for them.
How long do they do the chanting for in the morning? Is it like half an hour? Or is it...
I don't know. I think it depends what time the abbot raises himself, whether he's been on the Chartreuse overnight, or the Benedictine, I should say, and how many people he's poked with a stick to come up for their gruel. And indeed, what tunes they haven't finished this week in the songbook.
The tunes? What, like Johnny H. Jazz? Shattered Dreams 80, by Johnny H. 80, Jazz.
Well, yeah, sums us up. I think that's going to be our theme music when we take our 80s disco on the road.
80s? Is it my 80s disco?
Let's go for
what we're going to discuss at the next live event, we'll discuss Carl Kobe's 80s disco, which was a thing. It was a very big thing in Brixton, South London. How long was it a big thing for, Carlton?
It was just over a month, unfortunately.
Well, I thought it was going to be a week.
We got heavied out of it. Yeah, really? Yeah. Basically, it's called the Crypt now, but back then it was just an underground
car park.
Kindergarten playgroup thing in the afternoon, and I thought this is amazing space, and so we had. It was called the Cat House. And I did a sort of a, I'll see if I can find a poster somewhere. I must have a picture of it somewhere. And we packed it out. We got timeout reviews and everything. It was great. And it was five quid to get in, but you got a 4-pack of Carlsberg as well.
What a classy deal,
yeah,
that was.
In you come, here's your Carlsberg. I'd actually managed to source Carlsberg for about 60p a tin. So I thought, well, let's give something back. So it effectively was £2.50, but so I didn't have to have a drinks license. I basically just handed out lager. If you didn't like lager, which some people really sniffy, £5 to get in. Oh, I don't like lager.
Oh,
well, hard luck then.
Give it to your friends.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, anyway,
cheer up.
We'll be discussing on the live show. We'll be saying which would be the best country in which to revive Carlton Kobe's 80s disco. I mean, that's not exactly saying which country is the most 80s. It might be saying which country is the most up for stuff. It might be saying that, mightn't it?
So, Albania's got to be up there, really.
Why? Why Albania?
I don't know. They like Norman Wisdom, and so do I. I'll go for that.
I think there's that sort of... I mean, you know, like Germany is still very big.
Is it dreadful? I think it might be an easy sell. I think that's why...
you've got to go to a place where there's nothing going on. You know,
yeah, exactly. They're just grateful.
There is a theory that if you just go round playing at smaller sort of market towns, in small halls, you can always sell them out because there's not much going on. That's not the theory that our Carlton Kobe live tour is built on, obviously. There's plenty going on in Oxford and Bath and Hemel Hempstead. And we will be coming
and Bournemouth
soon.
And, yeah, Sevenoaks.
There's plenty going on in Bournemouth. Crikey. Anyway, so that's the 80s disco. Never mind that. So now there's 63 statues of the Virgin Mary in Puy-en-Velay. 63 statues. It's a big pilgrimage place.
I think they were all turned to look at my room when I actually came out onto the balcony that day. Puy-en-Velay, it is heavy with emotion. And somebody within the... I don't really want to say spirituality because it depends on... you know, how you hang that way. But it is certainly quite heavy. And somebody in the Tour de France organisation, the ASO, somebody there is trying to buy their way into heaven because even if the race is an hour or 2 hours away, we stay there. And you end up rolling into town as a ragtag bunch of journos just wanting to have a pizza, a few beers and shoot the breeze. And everyone else is walking around as if they're shackled by their own emotions. Very, very, very strange place. I mean, go there, experience it, and then run away. I turned up once, and I think it may have been there that we got the flyer for the accordion world championships. I need to find that flyer because we put it up as the front page of this this podcast. That's also the place that Dan Lloyd and I, was that the place? Oh, no, it's when Sean Kelly and I decided that we weren't going to follow the official evacuation because it looked like it was really, really bad. clogged up with the team buses and everything. So Sean decided to head out in exactly the opposite direction, in with the idea that we would be able to circle the town on what he believed must surely be a lip ring road around the sides of the escarpment that was cut into by this valley. And so we left and we drove around for about an hour and a half, and eventually we came back to exactly the spot that we left behind. And so all the teams had left, all the media had left, bloody hell. And then we were actually stuck behind, of course, all the fans. And this place is used to pilgrims actually coming in on hands and knees. You know, lots of fountains to bathe your wounds, but nothing to alleviate the mood of Sean Kelly, who'd found himself back in town after a meaningless loop, and then very, very late for his dinner later on. So, yeah, he wasn't
happy. For his pizza. Now, but of course, in September, you know what goes on?
Pizza.
In September, they have the Bird King Festival. Do you know about this?
Go on.
Now, it's a Renaissance masked carnival celebrating the talents of the city's best archers. What do you think of that?
Oh, archers, not falconers.
Archers, no, it's weird, isn't it? But you know, I just thought we could touch on the carnival, which I think is something that is not done well. Let's take Notting Hill out of it, but not done well in England. You go to the seaside carnivals. What, have you been to many of those with the floats? I don't think they're done, you know. In Europe, I think maybe they've got the medieval traditions survive more heartily. In England, it'll just be like a local builder driving his van through the streets. I mean, it's nonsense.
Or someone like Anthony the Aged playing Catch an Orange. I said, what?
What is that?
Yes, you see, I don't know. Is it the best fates? Should we call them fates? Rather than carnivals.
Well, I'm thinking of a parade. I'm thinking of an actual procession.
Well, they usually end in one, don't they? They sort of have a few floats.
Yeah, yeah.
They're called floats, aren't they? Which is basically a builder's merchant flatback with somebody vaguely glamorous on the top.
No, but sometimes they'll have a tableau
dressed themed of something. But yeah, usually absolutely terrible.
But so in between, so there'll be like, I don't know, local scouts who'll be doing a tableau of Heidi High or something. We've been asked to appear as Jeffrey Fairbrother and Ted Bovis. They'll do a nice little tableau. But then there'll always be a lot of just like people in vans. Like, I don't know, it always just seems a bit, you know.
Where's this going?
Underwhelmed.
Spain actually do the very, very best, provided they're not chucking a donkey off a tower or indeed skinning cats. They do these little tiny festivals very well. In France, it tends to be a much quieter affair. I don't know if you've noticed. They do have fetes, and they have these days which are brocantes. The brocantes in France, go and look it up if you don't know what one is. It's basically a tax-free street party that you can actually sell your crap. Sorry, your ephemera. And they're called brocantes because everything's broken.
I should say.
I reckon.
I should say.
But they are absolutely gorgeous. And they usually have a theme around them, or indeed they have a sort of a fete gathering there. And a lot of dealers, antiques dealers, actually go over there to pick stuff up. And in the olden days when I owned a farm in the north of France, I used to go and get basically the furniture for the farm, including some spectacular little go-down stoves, which I gave away stupidly for nothing because they only cost me like about 15 quid a go. Mm. Apparently they're now worth £500,000-£600,000, these things. And they were beautiful, one of which looked exactly like, it was a go-down stove for a bedroom, and it was blue enamel. It was in the shape of the TARDIS, Doctor Who's TARDIS. And it was so beautiful, and I gave it to the removals man as a tip when I moved to London. Why did I do that?
I should say we should we haven't done anything about Spain at all in this series, so
or the Tour de France. Actually,
no, we'll be doing the Tour de France in a minute, but we should perhaps revive the lockdown format to do the Vuelta, maybe, you know, as a kind of late season throwback. Anyway, and also, why don't we should do a live event in Paris, shouldn't we? That's where we should do a live event. That's where the audience is.
Well, we've got to be at Montmartre if we're going to do it at all, with the old view of the city. Looking down from the mount itself to my old apartment, which was just above the bistro, which in Place des Abbesses, there it was, the Rue de Steinkerque. If you ever want to find my old apartment, there it was. It was a tourist office that I saved, ripped it out. When my wife came, she was expecting a beautiful atelier, something spectacular that she could pretend to be an artist in. And when she got there, it was actually a tourist office. It was a place that and she actually cried.
She cried.
She cried. Is this it? Yeah, this is it.
Well, it's in Montmartre. It was in Montmartre. I mean, how bad could it be?
I know, exactly.
Well, it's not going to be a tower block, is it?
There is the Sacré-Cœur. We're on the first floor above a restaurant. And because it was Place Saint-Pierre, directly opposite the tumbling down steps and the carousel there, by the way. So it had that view. You open the shutters and there was Montmartre, the Sacré-Cœur. Absolutely beautiful. But she was convinced that, of course, it would be so noisy we wouldn't be able to sleep. But there is a regulation there that all bars have to be shut at 6 o'clock because of the monastic duties that have to take place on the top of the mount. There's a nunnery and the rest of it. So they lock the doors, obviously, of the Sacré-Cœur, lazy bastards. And then they walk around swinging a bit of incense, have a bit of gruel and pop themselves off to bed and insist... Thankfully, I am grateful for this, that, of course, they must not be disturbed because they'll be up for morning vespers as soon as the sun rises, of which I never used to hear them at the bottom of the mount. But anyway, it was lovely.
So hang on a minute. What, the bars in Montmartre are shut at 6 o'clock every evening. Is that right?
Only on Place Saint-Pierre in the foot of it.
Oh, I see. But also, we should say, there's a lot of religion in today's podcast, listeners.
So far, there has been, yeah.
We should say, though, that the route is also going close to the Lourdes. We've already talked about the pilgrimages and the 63 Virgin Marys in Puy-en-Velay. But it's on the POW stage, which is in the first week, it's going close to Lourdes, isn't it?
That's right. We head down very quickly, actually, after all of these skittles stages where we'll be knocking a few down on behalf of the sprinters. Suddenly, boom, we're in the Pyrenees. They run from Pau to La Rune is very, very close to Lourdes.
Stage 9, actually, not the first week, just after the first week.
The first property I ever tried to buy, actually it's the second one, but anyway, was an advert that was in the early morning editions at TVAM, where I used to work, the old breakfast broadcaster, with the mad Bruce Gyngell in charge. It was fantastic. A man who once sent me out to buy a trampette just so he could do an interview with the Daily Mail while bouncing up and down, because he just said, crazy's good and people remember you. Anyway, that's then. I tried to buy a ski lodge. It was actually a berger, so it was a shepherd's hut, essentially, that had been shishied. So it was stuck on the side of a mountain, not that far from Pau. And it had a little car pull-in off a mountain road, so your car went straight underneath. It was like a hollow garage. Steps up the side to a salon. It was about 38 square metres, if I'm not mistaken. And it had a real fire, a wood store at the back of the little car pull-in. So you had to go downstairs in the blizzard to get your wood. No light. So it was oil lamps and just the cosiest bed and sofa you could possibly imagine. And it was 11.5 grand. I know.
Ridiculous.
And I set off. It was advertised in the Observer, and we used to get the early morning papers at TVAM, hence I remember why. And I thought, oh, that sounds like a bargain. So I rang the bloke out of bed and said, I'm coming over to see it tomorrow, because I'd finished my weekend shift. And I decided, and it was quite difficult to get to Pau then, because the airport wasn't as well connected as it is now. Anyway, I set off. And when I got there, he told me it had been sold to also somebody from England, who he said he thought was me. And the guy just bought it with his Visa card. I mean, that is cruelty beyond belief.
That's ridiculous. I thought it was going to be someone else from TVAM. That would have been good, wouldn't
it?
No. Now, at Lourdes.
So, yes, we're going to Lourdes.
So, Bernadette, so she was a teenage girl who saw the vision of the Virgin Mary in 1858, right?
That's right.
And do you know, after she first saw her, how many times did she see her subsequently to that?
Every Thursday, knocking off time.
She saw her 17 more times. She saw her 18 times in all, saw this vision. And yeah. And there was already like a sort of a shrine, a pilgrimage place, like quite nearby. And that place eventually has like shut down. And now Lourdes is like the centre of the world for... Have you been there? What's it like? This is a place where you go to get healed because it's got religious significance. So is it full of people in wheelchairs and so on?
Yes, it's very heavy with that. The hopeful and the faithful, I think you could describe it. And there are huge walls with basically walking assistant, various bits and pieces. People hang up their crutches and various
frames.
Bits and pieces. Yeah, it's extremely impressive, and you know, if and they all apparently are veritable. Then you know, beatification doesn't take place until it's actually been proven that there have been miracles or completely unexplained by medical science. Mm. Improvements in health. I mean, you know, there are occasions of people just improving in their health anyway. But yeah, I mean, though, it's quite personal to me, actually, because my next-door neighbour when I grew up in Sheffield, on Crimicar Lane, there was a young lad, I believe a relative of his, who had one failing kidney and nothing else, and it was basically going to die. And was taken there and was back to full health. And when they scanned him again, he actually had two kidneys. And it was this very, very intense, very intensely religious family. And it was something that I can't really get over or explain.
Well, so the hospital diagnosed him as having one failing kidney. And after he went to Lourdes, the same hospital with the same scanners, whatever.
Yes.
Said he's now got two good kidneys.
Correct.
What about that?
There you are.
Well, and if you had...
To be honest, it's not something... The chap who lived next door, his name was Peter White. It was quite remarkable. Yeah, there we are.
Well, if you had minute 28 in the sweepstake for the first miracle of the podcast...
There we are. So what I'm trying to say is you won't get anything that's going to besmirch the reputation of Lourdes coming out of this podcast.
No.
Because I find it
we're looking for sponsorship sponsored by Lourdes.
We are indeed. But there was one thing that I did find highly amusing when we were there, and that was that the shoe shops, you're normally shoe shops just put out let's say a left shoe on racks outside. Well, there are so many people who are missing a foot that basically they had to stop doing that because these shoes kept going missing.
No.
They only needed the one. Yeah.
What is the moral compass of someone who goes to Lourdes with faith in the Almighty but steals shoes? What?
A shoe?
What's going on there? What's going on?
Yeah. Oh, you can have a nice selection of just one shoe. But of course, it's always the left shoe, isn't it? Is that right? That they always put out? I can't remember.
I don't know. But, it's a long time since I've seen a shoe shop.
No, but all shoe shops have to agree which shoe to put out because otherwise you just go and get the right shoe from
Lillian Skinner.
Clark's attacker or commando, whatever it is, with a compass in the heel. You get the right shoe from one shop in Didsbury, and you get the next one. You'd be prepared to travel to Catford to get the other one. So yeah, I think they all. It's like an unspoken rule of shoe shops that you have to put out the left shoe, so that with people don't make up pairs by just cruising around town.
Joy for cobblers globally. That's what I'm calling that. So anyway, so that's. But now we're doing this all cobblers. In reverse. Why are we doing? Why are we doing the route in reverse? I'm not editing this to put it in the right order because now we're going to go to Lyon. And now, when do we get to Lyon, Carlton Kirby? Can you divulge?
Yeah, we get to on stage 15. So we're only 2 days. We will have just about recovered from our visit to Puy.
So we do end there on stage stage 14 on Saturday that weekend. So big weekend. So Lyon is that weekend. It's the second weekend of the tour. But Lyon's very connected. Now, we've discussed Lyon before because, of course, as we've said, many of the preamble races, cover the same territory. But Lyon's very big for the Tour de France, isn't it?
Huge. Well, it's the Crédit Lyonnais. And in fact, it's the bank yellow, which is quite a banana-y yellow. There's a bit of red in there somewhere for your colour palette if you're going to redesign it. The various yellows that have been the yellow jersey over the years, they do vary. Some of them have been very pastel, but at the moment it's quite rich, as is Lyon and the bank Crédit Lyonnais itself. And in fact, the city is very much a heartland of finance, not that far from Switzerland. I think it probably has something to do with it. But they are the ones, of course, who have the lion, which is the very coveted, cuddly toy. You can buy them, but you can't buy the real ones. It's a bit like you can only buy replica kit from professional football teams. You cannot buy the real gonk or the real Crédit Lyon, the lion that they give to the stage winners. And these things are actually kept in safes, and they're extraordinarily sought after.
Who gets a lion?
The winner, stage winner every day gets a lion, and then the winner of the race overall, including the team. So whoever wins the team competition, they keep these lions in a safe. I'm not joking. They keep them in a safe because they're so coveted, they just go missing. And when they had the teams competition a couple of years ago, there was they were handing them out to each rider who was on the roster to get one of their lions, and there was one missing. And all hell broke loose because seriously, there's proper investigations of where this has gone. And lo and behold, Sean Kelly walks into the commentary position with one of these lions.
Well, the lion.
And I said, where did you get that, Sean? He said, oh, somebody just in the organisation said, you better have one of these. I have no idea where they come from. And I swear, his lion actually should have been given to whoever it was. Was it Movistar? I think it might well have been. Anyway, poor old Sean. Well, not poor old Sean. He's got one of these coveted lions, and they are you can't find them. You can't find them on eBay. You can't find them anywhere. Any lion that you find on eBay is not the real one, because when the teams win one of these, they actually put it traditionally in the front of the coach, next to the driver, looking out of the window, so that everyone will know that they have just won a stage of the Tour de France. Remember, I said that I thought that when they were asking for tips as the Giro d'Italia, I said there should be a checkerboard jersey for the stage winner. Yes. Well, there is something for the stage winner that reflects that, but it's a cuddly toy that gets left behind, but is paraded the next day by the coach, and of course, the car, sometimes it's actually moved to the team car, and you're at the front of, you have the pecking order if you lead the race, and quite often the stage winner does, and there's your lion for the crowds to cheer. How lovely is that? Lovely tradition.
Oh, yeah. That's good. There's a lot of material on that. So, as we've said before, Lyon, I think it's underrated. I think you could go there for your weekend break. Now I'm going to sound like Judith Chalmers. I'm going to say it's a very elegant city. It's like the kind of best of Paris in its architecture, that kind of late, elegant 19th century architecture. Two rivers, the home of French gastronomy, of course, the Nouvelle Cuisine. Yes.
Don't take me there.
The Nouvelle Cuisine. You love the Nouvelle Cuisine, don't you? You love
Forget
it.
Forget art on a plate. Just give me something to eat,
chips,
for goodness sake.
I must say, it's a recurring theme that when you start talking about food, it's always got to be value and for a price.
Yes, it's got to basically be a taste sensation, hearty and cheap
for under £3.50.
Yeah, that's right. Unless there's wine involved, and then I'm prepared to push it for to a fiver. Follow les routiers. Don't follow les Michelin stars. Follow les routiers. The routiers are the truck drivers, and if you see a routier sign, it's good. Simple as that. It's good enough for a trucker.
Well,
and that's good enough for me.
If your
truckers are picky.
But if your romantic weekend doesn't include going to a lot of lorry drivers' cafes on motorways, listeners, you could go to Lyon, which is full of wonderful, slightly more expensive restaurants. Well, you won't see Carlton Kirby because he'll be having egg and chips somewhere out on the ring road.
Get yourself to the bus station. That's all I'm saying. Get yourself to the bus station. That's pick a cafe there that's full of people who are just steaming in the wintertime. You'll find that you're gonna. You might quite often it just says le menu. That's it, le menu. And it'll say €5, probably €10 these days. But anyway, you just go and you go le menu. That's all you need to say. Le menu, s'il vous plaît, merci. And what you'll get is something like, I don't know, pigeon casserole, basket of bread, some boiled potatoes, and some Côte d'Aronne. Côte d'Aronne is the sort of throwaway wine in France, and it's just the best. It's the best you can possibly imagine. It's gluggable. It's fruity. It's got, you know, it hasn't got that stupid Cabernet Sauvignon grape in it. Oh, why is that? You know what Cabernet Sauvignon means? Dusty cabinet. You know when you open up when you pull out a drawer that you haven't opened for ages and you just get that smell? That's it. Who wants that in a glass? Obviously, people in Bordeaux. Forget Bordeaux. There we are. There we are. I've just swept away
I quite like it. What can I say?
Chuck it.
Anyway, we haven't discussed. We're going to discuss this on the next live show. It's raging. What's divided the nation is the barbecue versus picnic debate. We're not going to discuss it. Don't say anything, Colin Kirby.
Oh, no.
Nope.
I won't.
So that's going to be July the 16th. But the last show, if show it was, depends what you mean by show, you can download it or stream it. If you go to radiodateevents.com, you can still buy the stream and watch it and rewind it for your own delectation. That'd be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it is. It was a great, fun night. Think of it as buying us a coffee and a bun.
Yeah, all this free, just to help us free content. What I call free content that we're giving you. But no, it was a great... I don't want to say intimate. It wasn't like that. But, you know, I know from listening to podcasts during the lockdown, I walk around my local neighbourhoods listening to the podcast week after week. Not our podcast. And then a football podcast, and then I went to a live show, and it was like, wow, this is the thing that was in my brain, and now it's on my screen. And that's what it's going to be like. Carlton Kirby, he's been in your brain for all this time, and now you're going to see him on your screen, live from his house, which looks a lot like the Palace of Versailles.
Well, it does. We've done a great job of buying extremely cheap furniture in the rough junk shops of Chesterfield. In fact, I did actually buy a Chesterfield from Chesterfield.
Brilliant.
And it was covered in a very, very much Aztec 80s fabric, which ties in with our theme, as will be. But a real Chesterfield, I don't know if you know this, is actually made of cast iron. Oh. It's not wood framed. And so you can sit against it on the floor and it won't roll away because it's that heavy. Our removal men wanted danger money to actually put it in our current house. Because honestly, I'm a pretty strong, big guy. I can't lift it. It is that heavy. I bought it from a junk shop for about 18 quid. Took it next door to an upholsterer, a guy called Terry. And I said, Terry, I'd like you to cover it in this cloth. And I gave him, which I'd bought in France, actually, which was, it was velvet. Sheer velvet, so not crushed, you know, nice and smooth. It was silk velvet backed onto linen, and it did cost quite a bit of money, this cloth. The cloth cost I think about 200-300 quid, whereas the chair itself I just picked up from 18 because they wanted it out of the junk shop. And I said, this is the cloth. He went, oh, lovely, Drelon. I thought, if I say, actually, my man, I think you'll find it's silk backed onto linen, the price would have naturally gone up. So I just said, Drelon, it's lovely, isn't it? The light copper. And I said, when will it be ready? Do you think possibly at the end of the week? At which point Terry, with his very emphysemic voice, said, I've only got these, and held up two plates of meat hands. It was a marvellous moment. But he did return me a spectacular chair, which I was sitting on in our last podcast. Maybe I'll give you a little tour of the lounge and the library area.
It's like an audition for the Antiques Roadshow or Homes Under the Hammer. What are the ones called on the... I don't watch daytime TV.
Well, you haven't mentioned Hugh Scully. You've already done Judith Chalmers. They were the same era. But...
now, what...
Hugh Scully, his face always, to my mind, looked like it'd been viced vertically, and all his features had been crammed into the bottom half of his
face.
Can
we say we haven't...
That was just me.
We have 7% of our listeners are in America, of course, and Hugh Scully...
they won't know who...
Well, he might
who
do, because
there's
that BBC
about.
America and stuff, you know, but he used to present a show about antiques on a Sunday afternoon.
They know the Antiques Roadshow in the United States. It's on public service broadcasting. And I think they might know who Hugh Scully is as well.
Not everyone watches everything on every channel, though. That would be too much. You know.
Oh, I don't know. It's a hobby.
We're here to educate. We're here to educate and inform. Well, so I feel we haven't... Of course we haven't done the Tour de France justice, because this is just a...
How can you?
It's just a taster. We're just talking a little bit about some aspects of France. And we've done a lot of the cycling, unbelievably, on the first live show. So please download that for money. And then you'll be... I mean, how much money are they going to win if they follow your tips? I mean, no money guaranteed, obviously.
Well, if they've done the treble, I think they'd be on for over £2,000 for a £1 tip.
£2,000? What? £1 out? In fact, £2,000 back.
If you could get the treble, it was 1,000 to 1, 175 to 1, and 66 to 1 were the riders I picked who were not going to it. Yeah, so they're multipliers. So what's 1,000 by? It'd be about £80,000 for a quid.
Do you have a bet on every race? Will you be having a race on the Sibiu Tour in Romania?
Obviously.
You do?
If I can find somebody who's offering odds. That's the problem. A lot of bookmakers these days don't actually do that. But yeah.
I mean, that must be one of the gambling areas where the number of people who work for bookmakers who know about the subject is maybe smaller than the number of people in the field who know about the subject. Well, because, you know, in football, I'm sure bookmakers can find plenty of experts to weigh up the odds. Whereas in cycling, who knows more than you?
Well, tune into the podcast and find out where the money is. Mm. That you can just go and pick up. Oh, it's like picking flowers in a field. Just tune in and enjoy.
Now, there's no way. Now, people have got their lives to get on with. But I can't see a way to get to Mike and Bernie Winters from this carefully plotted labyrinth of chat.
We're not going to get there. Part of the fact that actually I saw their blue plaque.
Oh, where's that?
Because they, it was at Thames Tennyson Studios before they actually knocked it down, but they've kept the plaques.
What did this say? Mike and Bernie Winters performed here.
Yeah, along with Harry Worth and various others. But yeah, they got superseded, didn't they? Mike and Bernie Winters was supposed to be the sort of crusty double act that would underpin the pushback for ITV against Morecambe and Wise, who were so successful on the BBC. And then, of course, they thought, stuff this, we'll just buy Morecambe and Wise. And that was the end of Mike and Bernie Winters. So we like to think of ourselves as that double act, obviously with... I like to think we maybe bring a bit more depth.
I thought you were going to say, I can't be the Mike Winters. I know it's a thing often said, but Mike and Bernie Winters are a double act with two straight men, isn't it? I mean, are they funny? I don't.
I don't know. There was catchphrase, wasn't it? That was it.
That's the big old grin, and he used to bring his dog on and all that. Is that? Who's your favourite double act?
We're better than that. Who's Schnorbitz? The dog actually was the dog, and that was a Saint Bernard, a Saint Bernard. So I guess that ties in with the Alps. There you go. There's your link.
Now we've got to stop. We'll do favourite double acts next time. Picnic versus barbecue, 80s nightclub, all on the live show. Plus, let's say that's the pre-season. So all this stuff, this is just all imaginary. Now we're into the real stuff. Mm. So the next live show, Carlton Cove's Guide to the Season, a gambling tip for every race. No, that's a bit much, isn't it?
I don't know.
A gambling tip for the first couple.
We'll be getting close to the tour then, and France will be getting very nervous. Because, of course, this year what they've done is they've drawn a line. Ile de Ré and Poitiers, I think, is about the northernmost they get in the west. And Planche de Belfi, the northernmost they get in the east. And if you draw a line across France, you've basically chopped off all of the north, save for Paris, of course, in the grand finale. So no Brittany, no Normandy, none of that sort of Calvados, none of the Champagne region. They've decided to ignore it all, but... What? The guys who come from those areas are going to have a great chance of winning it. And Julian Alaphilippe, I think, could well win this year's race. I thought it last year at 150-1, and he came close. This year, the bookmakers have scythed him down at the ankles. Money-wise, I think the best you can get is about 10-1 on Alaphilippe. But the course is designed for him. It's his. And that uphill time trial at the end to Planche de Belfie, 36 kilometres of basically time-trialing lump. It's made for him. It's the ramp that will celebrate French victory. There you go. Which means that all of my side bets you'll have to do each way, because it's an Alaphilippe victory.
Well, we should say that the secret tips on the paid-for vlog cast,
yes,
are the each-way bets, the people who are going to finish in the top three.
That's right.
Yes. He hasn't just blurted out the top secret information, listeners, as if. Well, if you go to radiodayseventsdotcom, we'll have all the latest updates. I've put a playlist there of the old French music in the style of Riton Lamennevel, who we had on the live show. He's the guy from the old Belleville Cafe in Paris where they have the traditional music. Well, final words to Carlton Kirby.
Stay safe and get yourself ready for what's going to be an amazing season. Oh, albeit compressed into about 3 or 4 months of madness. I'm your man for that.